You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. We've all heard the horror stories about what's going on the southern border of the United States. People sick and dying in filthy, squalid prisons, children separated from their relatives, and so much more. Today we're going to be talking to an immigration attorney, Allegra Love, about the legal and humanitarian realities of these people's lives. We'll be back with that in just a half a minute. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Allegra Love. She's an immigration attorney, she's executive director of the Santa Fe Dreamers Project, and she will be speaking on Wednesday, the 17th of July at 5:30 in a forum called State of the Border. It's a public forum on immigration at the United Church of Santa Fe at 1804 Arroyo Chamiso Road. Welcome back, Allegra.
Thanks. Always great to talk.
Always great to talk to you about topics that just when you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse, namely the situation for both adults and children on the border, the southwest border, New Mexican border, Texas, of the United States between the U.S. and Mexico. Let's just start with this. What are you seeing?
What we're seeing on the southwest border is pretty wild. Essentially, there are unprecedented numbers of people arriving at our border seeking asylum. I think that the month of June, there's something like 150,000 apprehensions, which is like three times of what it was last year at this time. And so what we're seeing is an already terribly designed system, the Trump administration system of enforcement, the detention and the enforcement of our asylum laws. That already very, very badly designed system is now being challenged by just wild volumes. And what we're seeing is the Department of Homeland Security's inability to keep people safe and like basically healthy and in some cases like even alive when they're coming to the border to ask for protection. You know, we've all seen like the grotesque images of the kids in the CBP facilities in Clint, Texas, you know, babies who are getting sick and dying. And I think we're coming to like a nexus of how this poorly planned, inhumane policy was supposed to stop people from coming. The whole design was like, look, if we make this really terrible, then we can stop asylum seekers from coming. That was what they bet on. And they made this terrible, violent, inhumane system because they said, if we make it this way, then families won't try and come to the U.S. But they didn't think, what happens if that the number of families double? And so where that intersects is just deadly conditions for asylum seekers.
One thing that sometimes gets lost in the conversation is what people are escaping from in the first place.
Yeah. This is kind of a tough question to answer. I've been working for the last 5 years with Central Americans' families fleeing violence, and the answer is pretty much always gang violence. There's two giant transnational gangs, the Mara Salvatrucha, the Mara 18, and they have taken control of the region, and like the kind of violence that you know, they're recruiting children into gang membership. They're killing people who can't pay their war taxes. They're in these huge territorial battles. But it's not quite that people are just in the crosshairs of gang violence. It's that this violence has sort of like collapsed the rule of law in these regions. And so like smaller gangs are starting to get territories. The police have no control. The police are paid off by the gangs. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that when that happens, the people in societies who are already vulnerable to violence, women in particular, LGBT folks, trans women, also experience elevated violence because of the chaos and the fact that the security forces are no longer in control. And so that is one of the factors. It's also like an extremely impoverished region. And, you know, people don't move for only one reason. Yes, sometimes people move because there's a gun to their head. Yes, sometimes people move just because they can't eat or can't grow food. They can't find a job that can support their family. But it's usually not just that. There's usually like a combination of factors that pushes someone into the really brutal decision to abandon home and migrate and ask for protection in another country. What's wild about this situation is this is a test run for our country and all sorts of other developed nations that have resources. Because when global warming happens and people in the equator and in the global south can't grow food anymore, we're not going to have like moral high ground because we were born in a northern climate that still is able to grow corn. There's going to be millions of people displaced who are like, they're not going to go back to places where they can't feed their children. So when I talk with rational people about this, people who are not interested in punishment, who aren't interested in white supremacy, who aren't xenophobics, that's what they're talking. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about how do we respond to this crisis? Because in a way that can scale up when in the coming years, these numbers just quadruple and just because people aren't going to be able to grow food. And it doesn't matter, like, whether we want them here or not. They just simply can't live in a region anymore.
And instead of going to a place now where there is a semblance of order and resources and stuff, as you're saying, they're going from chaos to chaos.
Yeah, but I think something that is, like this is a chaotic system for us, and certainly Mexico is chaotic, and the Mexican border right now is as chaotic as it can possibly be. But I think we have to respect that these migrants are rational people, right? And this is something I always discuss when I'm discussing migration. If families continue to choose the chaos of the U.S. detention system, the chaos of the Mexican border, over what they're fleeing in their home countries, we have to give them the credit that they're rational people and that there's something unlivable. Like if they're opting for this mess, we have to give them the benefit of the doubt that what they're fleeing is worse.
Do they know what a mess it is? Does that message filter down into the countries they're coming from?
You know, it's hard to say. And obviously, I can't speak for hundreds of thousands of migrants, what they know and don't know. I've worked a few times on migrant caravans, advising people of their rights and, you know, like talking to them about the process of asking for asylum in the U.S. as far south down as Puebla, and also the Guatemalan border. I've worked with people in migration trying to talk to them about realities of U.S. detention. And I'd say some people can hear that, but then, you know, migration is a process of hope, right? And a lot of people are just like in God's hands, they have nothing. And if you're going to surrender your hope, that might be the last thing that you have. So when this lawyer is coming from 2,000 miles away and being like, "It, you know, this is, it's really bad. You have to think about whether you want to do this decision. This, that, and the other might happen." Like, I think that people hear it intellectually, but they need to believe in a different story to propel them towards safety. And so I don't know. That's just been my experience.
Right, right.
But the most important thing, if like anyone is listening to this recording, the most important thing you can take away from someone like me is there is no illegal way to ask for asylum. It doesn't even belong in it. The word illegal doesn't even belong in a sentence with the word asylum. International protocol is that you arrive in a country. It doesn't matter if you come through the port of entry. It doesn't matter if you cross the border and you ask for protection. There is no illegal way to do it. The media gets this wrong almost 100% of the time. And our politicians absolutely do. They still seem to think that there is an immoral, illegal way to come and ask for protection. And it simply doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. Now, I know people out there are like, "Oh, yeah, crossing the U.S. border is a crime. Yeah, it's a federal misdemeanor. But that doesn't mean that they're illegally asking for asylum. There's international right that supersedes whatever the criminal charge. They could probably still be charged. I mean, that's what the whole zero tolerance policy was about last year, is that you can be charged for that act of crossing the border. But it doesn't make you an illegal immigrant, and it doesn't make your asking for asylum illegal. I had a New Mexico legislator ask me yesterday, why don't people just do it the normal way? And I was like, what's the normal way? This is the normal way. This is the way. They are not going outside of any norms to do it. And I think that that point has been really, really lost in all the yaya that's going around in the media and the news. Is yaya like a technical term?
I believe it's a legal term.
Yeah.
I was reading an article yesterday from NPR, who got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very important point, because the idea that people can flee inhumane, violent, deadly conditions and look for safety, that is actually, and this is a good thing, inscribed into our international norms and to some extent laws.
No, to full extent, the 1980 Refugee Act and the Immigration and Nationality Act, Section 208, for all you lawyers out there. Section 208 of the Immigration and Nationality Act actually says, this is how you seek asylum. It does not matter if you come to a port or between ports of entries. This is the way you're prescribed to do it.
Meanwhile, when they arrive, they're treated, I mean, like criminals, like animals in a confined operation of some kind. The conditions, the sanitary conditions, the temperature, the hunger, the lack of water, the lack of soap, toothbrushes, people sleeping on floors, having their beds taken away, having no beds in the first place, living in cages, metallic blankets. And then children are prevented from hugging their brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm. This is all correct. And I talk to migrants all the time. It's my job to work with asylum seekers. And they're bewildered. They're like, why am I being treated like this? I didn't just do anything wrong. I did exactly what I was supposed to do. Why? I mean, I work less in those facilities than I do in ICE detention, where people are in literal jumpsuits, chains around them, prisons, counts. The food is terrible. They have no medical care. They're literally incarcerated like criminals. And they're like, why is this happening? What crime did I commit? It's just our policy and our way of dehumanizing them to the point that we can see images of this just complete human rights violations and feel like a little bit desensitized to it. And it's kind of this like weird feedback loop where someone like me says, these people aren't criminals. And then someone says, well, if they're not criminals, why are they being put in jails and detention centers and being treated like criminals? And you're like, well, that's just because that's our policy. And you sort of like get this confusion of like, if they aren't doing anything wrong, then why on earth would we be treating them like this? Because we sort of like believe in this like American myth of like justice and due process, and that this kind of thing could never happen in our country. So we still believe in that so much that when we see our government treating people like this, we're still like, well, they must have done something wrong. But in reality, this is the American reality, that these people are completely innocent of any crime and are being treated like animals and criminals, which has just like horrifying comparisons to genocides in the world.
I have so many responses to that. And one of them is, I keep thinking about how many times in history the people of the United States have to lose their innocence, and then they somehow regain that innocence all over again. I mean, we come from our own perpetrations of genocide and slavery and so many kinds of war abuse abroad, and we're still doing it, and yet somehow people act, gosh, how could we do that? Well, we've been doing it all along. I mean, that's one of the responses to that. And then the other is, to me, that there's a lot that comes from the top. So if you have somebody who's in charge of the country or is trying to be in charge of the country who has that attitude, it filters down and creates or fosters a culture of inhumanity.
Absolutely. And I think that that culture, unfortunately, infects even those of us who consider ourselves liberal and progressive. I've been reading a lot, not a lot, but I've sort of been browsing the idea of genocide and what the eight stages towards genocide are. And the third step is dehumanization, and that's sort of where I'm stuck right now. And the reason that's a stage towards genocide is dehumanization allows us to overcome the revulsion we feel when others are killed. And I've been thinking about that a lot, and like how we're able to now look at pictures of drowned babies in the Rio Grande. We were speaking off mic about the young black man who was killed for listening to rap in a convenience store, and just like how this we are being conditioned to overcome how disgusting and revolting and unacceptable that is. And not necessarily that we're saying it's okay, but that we're able to just like move on with our day and function knowing that that is going on is because of how effectively the other has been dehumanized in this country. It's wild and it's disgusting, and I'm ashamed of myself.
Well, the shame that we all feel, and you were talking earlier before we started about disappointment.
Yeah, I feel... I'm traumatized. I'm scared. The things that I have to witness on a daily basis, the things that I have to know and understand, the things that I am capable of stopping and I just can't actually do because of government policies. All of that is contributing to this deep sense of sadness, but really, really it's disappointment. It's disappointment that we are not better than this, that, you know, I've had to learn from history that societies are capable of doing terrible things to whole groups of people, and always sort of expecting that would never happen in my country. And it's just this profound disappointment that we are not exceptional, and that even through all these lessons of history, even though we all have the clear moral guideposts that this is absolutely the worst way we can treat other human beings, we are still allowing it to happen in this country.
And there are alternatives.
Yeah, this idea that like that the Trump administration and even all political leadership and people in this country, that this is like the only possible paradigm for processing asylum seekers is bonkers. Another legal term, bonkers. People always say, well, what would you do? I know exactly what I would do. I would not appropriate millions of dollars to the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security has proven incapable of caring for the safety and the lives of the people who are seeking protection in our country for like so many reasons, whether it's the fact that, I mean, like something like 9 children have died in this migration on our soil in the last year, and that we have evidence that these, from that like Facebook group thing, that these officers are like unchecked racism and sexism and like vulgar bigotry in public spaces.
So, and gloating with each other.
Yeah. And I mean, you should see the way that like ICE officers respond to my like cries for help that one of my clients is sick or one of my clients in their custody needs attention, just with like brazen disregard for the well-being of that person. Anyway, my point is I think we have enough evidence now that DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, Customs Border Protection, is not capable of doing this job correctly. So we need to reappropriate the funds that we are giving them and say, you don't get to do this anymore. I think that we need to take custody of people in a safe place for the length of time we need to make sure they're healthy and to ascertain their identity. And then they need to be released to NGOs on the border who know what they're doing. We can put a government RFP out for those millions of dollars that we're appropriating to ICE to let NGOs with experience in migration take care of the humanitarian aid on the border. We don't have to. Customs and Border Protection and ICE don't have to do it. I mean, the reason the tension is about theories of punishment, right? Whenever you're confining someone, when you're taking custody of them, putting them in a prison or a jail, it's about what are we teaching society about this? What are we trying to control? And it makes no sense with asylum seekers, right? The reason you would detain someone is if they were a threat to national security, or if they were a flight risk, meaning that if you release them, they wouldn't show up for their deportation hearing that's later going to come. Because all these people are going to have deportation hearings eventually to defend their right to stay in the country under political asylum. So when you're holding like thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cages and jails, these are people who are not threats to national security. And they're 90%, they show it, like 90% of them show up for their hearings. They're not flight risks either. So the only theory of punishment that is being served by confining people is by like sending a message to more asylum seekers that they shouldn't come, by trying to control migration through punishment, which is not humane. And it's actually like against UN protocol about how to treat refugees.
And a lot of the people who are coming have relatives who are ready to take them in.
Yeah, I mean, listen, most migrants don't just wander off into other countries without a plan, right? Some do. Some are so desperate they have no other choice. Most people have a plan. They have a contact. They have a relative. They have a friend of a relative who they have made a plan with to receive them. This isn't categorical, but it's like almost in all cases. When these camps down on the southern border, in Las Cruces and Deming, when people are being released into the U.S. and churches and nonprofits are taking care of them, they don't stay in New Mexico. They all are going to other points because they have plans of where they want to be. And they're also planning on showing up in immigration court and defending their right to political asylum because they're not criminals. They actually are very law-abiding. And so when a notice to appear in immigration court shows up at their address saying you need to come talk to the judge, they show up. They're too afraid to act outside of the law. You know, I know that goes directly against this like sort of concept of the migrant as the lawbreaker, but most of my clients are way too afraid not to show up in court.
What is happening to the whole issue of children and their parents being separated? That apparently the people who are doing this aren't even really totally keeping track of where these children are going. Some of the children are in foster care with complete strangers. What's going on?
So we have to be careful right now, this summer, about how we use the term family separation. Family separation last summer in 2018 was this official policy of separating children from their biological parents. It was done by levying criminal charges on the parents for crossing the border and putting them into federal custody, federal criminal custody, and using that as a way to sever their custody of their children long enough to get them apart. I think most people remember that. That was the zero tolerance policy, and that was the official family separation policy. That is not what is happening on the border right now. We have not revived any policy of parent separation. I say parent separation because kids are still being separated from family members. You can only stay with someone if they are your biological parent or have like legal custody papers that you're like legal guardian. So like I'm an aunt. If I showed up with my four niece and nephews on the border, I would be separated from them. So that's like technically that's family separation, but that's always been the case. That's federal law. And there's no like revived policy of parent separation happening right now. However, the chaos is not making, like, the chaos is not making any of this easier. And there are still kids who are being separated from their parents because of, like, the collateral mess that is going on. Like, there's tons of reports of kids being separated from their parents because how messy and chaotic this system is. And once they're separated, it's really, really difficult to reunite them. My staff at Santa Fe Dreamers Project has been working on a border project now for the last year with various other partners, helping to reunite parents and children who were victims of the 2018 policy. And it is extraordinarily difficult. Probably the most grotesque case we had that we worked on was a kid who was separated from his dad for 11 months. And we had a massive legal team working that whole time trying to get them reunited. It's incredible. It's an incredible sloppy and policy, and it's like staggeringly stupid when you consider the effects that it has on child development and that child's ability to thrive. I mean, we've done incredible damage to children.
And this is something, I mean, it's so easy to do damage quickly, and it takes years and so many resources for a child to heal, if they even can heal. I mean, some of these people are going to be scarred for life.
I don't think you need to be a doctor to understand that. The kind of traumatic events that these kids are enduring are going to inhibit their ability to thrive, unless they are like the most resilient children in the world, which I believe some of these kids are. And I think it is going to take a very, very, very long time to understand the damage that we've wrought on this population of Central American children. And we are going to owe like a massive debt to this community. And I don't know how our country will ever be able to provide any sort of reparation or restitution. Obviously, we probably won't. Reparations for slavery, reparations for the violence that we did to the Native American people, that's something that is still unclear how that will ever be occurred. Now, obviously, this isn't the same situation. But...
Well, this is going on in real time.
Yeah.
And people also seem to forget that a generation ago, there were wars, civil wars in these very same countries. People fled to the United States. They didn't get the services they needed. Some of those kids joined gangs. Then lots of people were deported. That gang culture went to these countries, and now it's coming back. It's coming to roost. I mean, there's a cycle of history that we are ignoring by not understanding why people are migrating in the first place. I mean, this has deep roots.
It has deep roots, and it's also just obvious if you are capable of any kind of systems thinking and like how dynamic our relationship is with the rest of the Americas and the rest of the globe. This is the exact same thing with global warming. How like, you know, our country and these developed nations are contributed massively to this phenomena. And then we're going to take a superior position when the people who our behavior and our lives have uprooted come and ask for space in our world. It's this like not understanding systems and having like a critical like not being able to critically evaluate how our behavior and like what we have as a nation is not only pushing people out of their countries but also pulling them in. We are the push and the pull of this migration. And we're acting as like if it has nothing to do with us and these people are just rotten people.
People who are listening to this program probably are, at least to some extent, aware of what's going on through reading, through whatever media they're accessing. The question of what each one of us as citizens can do is something that I wanted to ask you about. What have you seen are the most effective actions so far? What do you think people can do? I mean, I hear sometimes progressive people say, we need to take to the streets. Marching isn't always, I mean, there are marches. Marching isn't always the most effective thing at this point because marchers are ignored. I mean, that has become the norm. What else?
God, this is such a difficult question that I've been contemplating for like half a decade now. I'm going to try to answer as best I can. The first thing I think anyone needs to understand when thinking about what can I do, how can I make a change, is that issues like this take an incredible amount of moral stamina. It doesn't mean making one single choice or taking one afternoon out of your day to march. It's about really, really committing to constantly taking the correct moral positions on how to unravel this sort of like structural oppression that is crushing people in our country and how to evaluate the inequity that is making situations like this possible. So that's really abstract. And people get really pissed at me when I give these abstract answers and I always are like, but what actually can we do? And I do have a few suggestions for that. One, like really You really need to educate yourself. I can't emphasize this enough. There's so much bad information going around. And there's all these, especially like progressive voices right now, very loud, but oftentimes very ignorant. And I don't mean ignorant in a sense that they're like immoral, but just like you don't know what you're talking about. And we really, really need to understand what we're talking about to be effective. This means getting off social media as your primary source for information about this and finding a credible source in your community that you're actually able to communicate with about what is going on here. In our community, we are constantly offering credible information. We're having in Santa Fe on the 17th, we're having an educational forum to talk about this stuff. It's hard because I'm constantly being treated as this is my opinion, you know, like that this is that I'm an activist and this is my sort of like propaganda to get what I want. But I am. No, I'm
a federal lawyer.
I'm a federal lawyer. This is my job to know this. And so in communities all across the United States, there are organizations, reputable organizations that can help you navigate this without having to figure out on your own which of these elevated voices is actually telling you the truth or not. So educating yourself is like first and foremost. Second, you have to give money to organizations that know what they're doing with that money. And there are the big ones that everyone gives money to. Raices being like a great example of that. We partner with Raices. They do awesome work. I can't say not to do that, but I would also consider there's certain like grassroots organizations that really, really need funding because believe it or not, grassroots organizations have an ability to be nimble and respond in a way that larger entities do not. I'm like under contractual obligation, of course, to always mention Santa Fe Dreamers Project, my organization. We work on the border. Las Americas is a great legal services organization that's working on the border. Al Otro Lado out of Tijuana is another amazing organization. Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. These are all places that are responding in real time to what is happening. I think also here in New Mexico, we need to funnel resources to the agencies and the churches that are actually receiving asylum seekers now in shelter. But really, really be clear with them about what it is that they need. I think a lot of people get like a fantasy idea. Oh, they need 7,000 diapers, let's say, and don't check in. And you can actually cause problems if you just show up with a bunch of donations. They usually have real-time lists of what they're needing on a day-to-day basis. And you really have to respect it because the needs change really dynamically in those situations. And you can cause problems for people and take away their human resources by needing attention for something that they didn't want. It's really, really important to also know you can't send donations to federal prisons or anything.
Right.
Like, you can't do it. And so that's just like a dead end. I think another thing that we have to do is really, really make sure we are talking to the right politicians. Our local politicians, like our mayor, even our statewide politicians, like our legislators and our governor, it's very, very important that they are aware and educated on the right side of things here. We also have to realize that there's a very limited amount that local and state politicians can actually do to affect these policies. It is our federal level politicians, our representatives and senators, Congress, and the executive, the Trump administration that can actually make changes. You cannot assume that simply because someone is a Democrat that they have the right positions on immigration. My work started under the Obama administration. I just always want to remind people of that. I don't see this as a partisan issue. I see this as an American problem. And especially as these campaigns are ramping up, the presidential campaign in particular, we can't just assume that someone like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie or whoever you're voting for automatically has a positive border policy. We have to pressure them. We have to pressure people running for Senate, running for the House to articulate an actual policy of how they are going to actually correct this issue and let them know if they can't articulate that, then we are not going to elect them to office. And I have no interest in protesting Republican politicians right now. I'm like, well, what good is that going to do? My interest lies in making sure that the people, the progressives that we put into office, are held accountable for what we expect of them and not rolling over and behaving fearfully in front of a Republican-dominated Washington, D.C. I mean, Nancy Pelosi just rolled over and refunded all this money towards the Department of Homeland Security regime. This regime that is killing people on our border, they just gave millions of more dollars to say, you're doing this terribly. Maybe if we give you more millions of dollars, you'll be able to fix it. Why would we do that?
And without accountability, oversight, or enforcement in this so-called humanitarian package.
Yeah. So I think, like, not being afraid to demand from the politicians you otherwise like and support that an expectation that they have a way to address this border issue. And if you want to have, like, some talking points about what you say to them, is get the money out of DHS hands and into the hands of an agency or an NGO that knows how to manage a crisis on this level and has regard for human life.
What are some of those non-government organizations that you think really could take this over?
I don't really know, because that's not what I do for a living, but, like, just throwing it out there, the Red Cross, people who respond to hurricanes, all the agencies in Europe that help with those the migration crises there, the International Rescue Committee. There's all sorts of places we can conjure up in our imagination, even if they were, like, you know, huge church services. We can offer the money out in a competitive grant process to see which of these entities can throw out the best idea about how to deliver humanitarian aid on the border and take it out of the hands of people who are not interested in humanitarian aid and are interested in a punitive, deadly enforcement regime. Will it be perfect? Absolutely not. This is still a crisis, right? The crisis is going to have damage. But why are the people running it part of, like, a racist, xenophobic agency under the control of a racist, xenophobic, bigoted president? It just doesn't make any sense. And it's just bizarre that we as a nation think that's something that we have to accept, that this is just sort of like a unalterable paradigm of dealing with migrants. It's just, I don't know where that has solidified itself in our consciousness. It's like the whole, like, abolish ICE thing. Like, yeah, we should abolish ICE. And people are like, we can't possibly do that. And you're like, why? It's a 15-year-old agency that has proven to be, like, monstrous and deadly and not had really any impact on public safety in the United States. So why can't we abolish it? Or they're like, we need to get rid of immigration prisons. And they're like, that's not possible. And why? Why do we need immigration prisons? Why do you personally think that this is a, like, unalterable part of American society that we have to detain 50,000 adult immigrants on any given night in massive corporate prisons that our tax dollars are shelling out enormous amounts of money for? It doesn't make any sense.
So there's kind of a failure of imagination, and there's a kind of trust that the authorities must know what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that is where I feel this disappointment, right? Is that, why are we still trusting that these decisions that our law enforcement and our government are making are in the best interest of people in our society? And I think that there have been times in America where that may have been true, and we're clinging to this idea that, like, if they're doing it, it must be good for us, even when we can't find any evidence that what they're doing is good for American society.
Well, I mean, one can't help but think about the ships carrying Jews escaping the Holocaust being turned away.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Allegra Love, we could talk about this all night and for the rest of time, but it's just about time to go. Let's talk about the event that is coming up on Wednesday, the 17th of July. What's going on?
So at the United Church of Santa Fe, I think it's at 5:30. We are having an educational forum to talk about what is going on the border. Some of the things we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about the various different detention centers and detention scenarios that people are in. We're going to talk about who's in each situation and why. We're going to be talking about the flow of people seeking asylum across our border right now. why some people are sent to Mexico, some people are sent to children's camps, some people are released, and some people go to ICE. We're going to be talking about the asylum process in general. And the purpose of it is to give advocates hard information that they can take and learn and be confident as they're moving into spaces of activism. And so we can get away from the constant bickering of like this, that, and the other. I would love it if we only get one thing out of that forum. If we could all sit there and be like, do we all agree that the word illegal doesn't belong in any sentence about asylum seekers? If we keep bickering about that, we're never going to move to the more elevated space, which is like, what do we do? How do we make this better? So just sort of finding some common information that we can stipulate to, that we understand what's going on, and now we're going to come together and figure out a path forward.
The event is called State of the Border, a Public Forum on Immigration. It's on Wednesday, the 17th of July at 5:30 at the United Church of Santa Fe at 1804 Arroyo Chamiso Road. Allegra Love is an immigration attorney and executive director of the Santa Fe Dreamers Project. They're on the web at santafedreamersproject.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And by the way, earlier in the show, Allegra referred to several grassroots organizations that are doing work on the border. I'm linking to them on radiocafe.org. Click on New Mexican and you'll find the show and that information there. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lanl Foundation for their support. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.